Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. You know what we do every Monday. We are bringing in people who have great careers, doing different things, using their voice for good, having fun. And today, we've got, I often struggle with how you define people who've done so much. So comedian, actor, host. This brother's been on Broadway. I didn't even know that. The original, one of the original kings of comedy, Cedric the Entertainer. How are you, sir?
What's good? I'm pulled up.
I appreciate you taking the time. You were on Broadway?
Yeah. I did a very short run of David Mamet's American Buffalo. It was me, John Leguizamo, and Haley Joel Osment. It was right before one of the big financial falls. That's what happened. I think it was either, so they had to be 08 or maybe 10, maybe 2010, somewhere in there. But our biggest backer was one of the Wall Street guys, and in the market crashed and he dipped out. So but we had like maybe like a 3-4 week run.
Wow. A little bit of everything. So we look back through the background. On The Pulse, we kind of bring people up to speed. And I was looking at how you got into this. How did you get into comedy in the first place?
I mean, you know, probably like most people. I mean, I was working at State Farm. I had a regular job, and it was a comedian who was a friend of ours, mutual friend of the group, was out working. And he would always often like, yo, man, that's funny what you just said. Can I take that? Oh, that's funny right there. Can I take that? And I'm like, yeah, go ahead. So he eventually came back and told me that, you know, he felt like I can do comedy. And he signed me up for a comedy competition. Kind of showed me how to do the things that I normally say, put it in a routine for me. And I went in and I won $500 the first time I did it. So I was hooked in at that point.
And you were an insurance salesman at the time.
Yeah, I was doing claims. So I was the person that after you had the wreck, I came in and deal with it.
I hear those stories. It's always amazing. Michael Blackson was working at Domino's in Philly and someone told him he was funny. Sarah Silverman, Tracy Morgan was just on with us and have similar situations. Y'all have to be a special kind of person when someone says you're funny and you're like, all right, cool, let's go with it.
I mean, you know, at that time, of course, you know, it was starting to be a great surgence of comedy. You're talking about early, you know, late 80s, you had like, the formulation of guys starting to grow. Eddie Murphy was killing it on Saturday Night Live. So he your age, you see somebody 19, 20 killing it, right? You start to have that belief like, oh, I can do that. And so then, you know, then came, you know, like the Wayans brothers and those guys started to do things and be on TV and doing specials and Robert Townsend. So you started to see more faces, not just on the regular kind of institutional shows, but things that really felt black to you. You know what I mean? Like it felt more black. You like, all right, well, I can do this without transferring like who I am to fit into the status quo. And so, and then of course the Def Jams and all those things started to come into the atmosphere. And then that's where the opportunity came. So you can look and see people that was examples for you and that at least gave you the courage to go like, well, yeah. Like you say, including that guy he was just somebody we knew. And I was like, he was out going around. He wasn't famous, but he was going around the country, going to different comedy clubs, making money, like making real money. I had a job. This dude talking about he coming home with $1,500, $1,500. I'm like, whoa.
It's like, maybe I am funny. Like, I should give this a try.
I'm at least that funny.
So was it then you do that and you're doing the circuit and some of the people that I've talked to again, like doing that comedy club routine, that's not easy. Like that's work.
No, you know, it's definitely, you know, again, generation I grew up with, where you get booked, you got to drive 8-9 hours to a show. You got to, you know, sometimes you got to stay in some very, very terrible situations, you know, you got to go. And do, if you working for the comedy club circuit back then, you would have to do from 8 to 11 shows to make $300, you know what I'm saying, as an opening act. But, you know, it was one of those things, if you did that 4 times, you know, in a month, then you felt like you made a little money that month. You know, you could pay your bills, you can handle your situation. So that was the hustle, right? And so And then you try to get some shows on some mid on your off nights, on your Mondays and Tuesdays, pick up a, you know, a little show at a bar somewhere where they pay you $100, $200 to show up. And, you know, that was the whole hustle.
So when people now, and I'm going to get to when you were the original Kings of Comedy, because I remember that and all the headlines then about all the money that was being made for people who kind of, like, really the first who took ownership of that. But that yeah. came a little bit down the road. Was Steve Harvey's show the first big break? What was the big break for you?
Well, I would probably say hosting BET's Comic View. Like, I mean, as far as, like, you know, like a personal break. I mean, getting on Def Jam, getting on the Apollo, those were really big milestones for, you know, just as a comedian. Like, Apollo was first and went and did the Apollo, got a standing ovation, was 1-0, never went back until I was a pro. Like, I did not take no chances with that Apollo audience. But then, you know, you get, you know, the opportunity to get on television in any kind of way. I became the host of Comic View first, and that gave me a little more of a, you know, kind of a household name, especially in the African-American community. And so then I was able to go around and tour, you know, and show up in Little Rock and Birmingham and show up and make, you know, a nice amount of money because I was the guy that hosted Comic View. So, you know, that became probably my biggest break. And then, of course, the Steve Harvey show after that was one that put you on like a kind of national TV platform.
So you're doing the circuit, you get on the TV, you know, you're having success throughout your career. And so there's a lot of different steps to talk about. And then the original Kings of Comedy. And the reason that was such a big thing, at least for me, when I first saw it in all the headlines, was you guys kind of took ownership of your own career. You're one of the first to do that, right? You guys put this together, you controlled the money, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. We had a partner that was the promoter, and he was the, you know, the fifth member of the Beatles, if you will, right? So but that's the way we did it. He was a young guy out of North Carolina. He put together the tour, and yet we owned the material, we owned who we were. We were all these individual, like, kind of stars that came together as one super group. And that was rare. You know, I mean, we had the model was based off of Superfest, which was the concerts where, you know, like Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder would be there. That was his concept, was to put like big acts all in one night. But, you know, because we were all individuals, we had to kind of figure out how to operate. And so we started to operate as a super group, as one big thing that went together. And so, yeah, you know, all of the guys, we had control of the rights to the film. We had control of, you know, what we made on the stage. And so that's how we ended up having the most success.
Were y'all cool like that, for real? Like, when you saw it, y'all seemed like brothers out there doing that. Did that grow or was that real?
No, I mean, of course, me and Harb, we locked in. We was, you know, because we were doing the Steve Harvey show at the time, and we'd come up. You know, he had a comedy club in Dallas where, you know, he kind of first saw me and put me in the spotlights. And so Harb was my guy, and then me and DL became partners because he was the first host of Comic View. And so when I came in, he handed me the baton and we did a tour together. And so then we became locked in. And B-Mac was always everybody's favorite dude. And so, you know, yeah, as the tour grew, we all grew. Of course, there was, you know, people know like the legendary contention that kind of happened between Bernie and Steve. But really everybody else, like me and DL still locked in to this day. We still tour brothers. Me and Steve still locked in, still touring. Of course, Bernie Mac, the legend, has passed on. But, you know, me and B was always locked in too. So, but it was kind of between those guys that it was just a little bit of contention. But for the most part, we was out there. I think that at the end of the tour, of course, when money came into play, that's why we never was able to do it again. It's like people kind of got to their individual corners and just kind of like, you know, did their own thing, except, you know, again. And it was hard to get those guys to kind of, those alpha males to lock in and understand that it was about the business, you know?
Right. But the first time when the checks start coming in, oh, okay, Like, this is not bad. Yes. Dude, sell out tours.
That was a whole nother lifestyle. That was private jets, and everybody had suites, and it was boss life, man. That Kings of Comedy was something else.
Did you guys realize at the time that you were kind of changing things? Like at that point, and again, we've had a bunch of people on a couple of weeks ago, guys from New Edition were here and telling the stories about you did all this and you did these sellout tours and you're traveling and you made no money. And you guys kind of changed the structure by having control of it.
Yeah. I think, you know, that was really a great thing. I mean, because it was individuals, you know, of course, that had done like arena tours before us, Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Andrew Dice Clay, that I can remember at the time. But they were all like these kind of individual juggernauts. No one had kind of taken the New Edition approach, the super group, like a bunch of guys together, and we all figured out how to, we all gonna eat and make money. So, and it was definitely, you know, it was definitely special. It was definitely the kind of thing that, it was definitely special. And definitely one of those things that started to change, you know, what other comedians were looking for, expecting, wanting to accomplish. And, you know, I think it even had the opportunity for sure morphed off to what became the blue collar tour with the white dudes. The country dudes took our model and did way more with it, you know, but they did that model and that worked for comedy in general.
Was it at that point, this level of success and seeing all of that, you've always throughout your career, a lot of the roles have been kind of representing us, you know, these empowering, positive, but funny, you know, kind of roles. At what point, production companies, different acts, did you realize it's not just about being funny, it's also about being empowering?
I mean, as a comedian, you just trying to work. Of course, you want to, you know, you blow up and get your career. But, you know, I was always like, again, I came from with a college degree. I came into it from the corporate side of things. So I always had these other kind of responsibilities. Even when I was on stage, my mother, who was a school teacher, you know, she never really wanted me to curse a lot on stage. So that was also another part of my brand. Like I never just, you know, was blatant with curse words or just being rude on stage or saying things that I thought just was, you know, intentionally offensive. And so that became a part of like who I was, you know, as a human being. And so I think that by the time I started looking for roles, those were the things that I wanted. Like I wanted things that I could sink my teeth into that I thought people would be like, that is exactly how I know that man. I know this person, right? So, you know, Barbershop would be one for sure. Johnson Family Vacation, you know, and again, we did things on Johnson Family Vacation that a lot of people kind of forget, but I love the fact that in the movie, I was separated from my wife. I wasn't like no super good dude at first, right? I mean, so you got to look at, like, he was a married man that had to fight for something. And I was like, yo, you kind of missed the story in that because the movie's just kind of this funny about being on vacation and all this stuff. But you forget, like, the real issue was Nate was egotistical and he had to fight to get his family back. I was like, oh, I love like that, the moment of showing this is what really happened, because I grew up in a household like that, you know, so it made sense to me, you know. Yeah.
And that was always, that was you, I'm locked in, I'm going to do this. You know, I'm not going to go off the path of them just trying to make me the profane, off the hook, offensive comedian.
Yeah, only when I saw it deemed it necessary. Like later on, I got an opportunity with Marlon Wayans to play this character in Haunted House, and the pastor was supposed to be off the hook. He was a priest from prison, and you know it was something that I remember my audience really loved, the fact that I was kind of, they felt that I was free. They were like, "Yo, you just was raw in that one," and I was like, "But that was a choice. Like that was a choice because that's what the character was." And so I think I'd earned that too. You know, I'd earned by being kind of this, you know, easily digestible, fun, acceptable, everybody love me kind of personality, for me to give you something that didn't feel like that at all. And at the same time, it did, like, you know, because it was still me doing it. So you love the fact that I was just cursing and wild and saying crazy stuff. But it was like, but it said, though. So that's right. What I really, really worked. So I definitely take chances. And, you know, I'm not one that's like trying to, you know, put myself in sidelines. But, you know, I also, you know, have, you know, kind of the moralistic guidelines that define who I am as a person. So
is it hard? And I you recently commented on the people trying to cancel Will Smith, but we'll talk about that in a second. But going backwards, I remember Barbershop that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
When we watched Barbershop, I think everybody who's ever been in a black barbershop saw the character and went, man, they're not offensive about that. Every barbershop's got that guy who's sitting in there going off on his own tangent and belief system, and I know what's going on. But there were some people who were upset about you playing that role in Barbershop.
Man, that was one of the first times in my career that I'd really felt ran up on true contentious energy, like that opposite side. And I could imagine if I lived in the day of the internet, like where, if it was Twitter and all that stuff, I might have got canceled. Like, you know, but at the time, I remember, you know, a lot of the large civil rights leaders called me. They were very upset about it. Of course, producers, we had different producers on the movie. It was a great deal of contention on what should be said and why. And, you know, and kind of to your point, my thing was, this character was a guy that was his job in the barbershop. He was older, he had his own belief system. And like most of our aunts and grandmothers and people we know, once they get over a certain age, dog, they not biting their tongue, man. They gonna say what they gonna say, and you just gonna have to deal with it, right, wrong, or indifferent. And that's what you find endearing about them. If you do anything short of that, then you don't capture exactly who this guy is, and that's all I was doing. So I would always defend that I was just playing a character. I'm not here to defend the words or whatever, you know. Even though I would had the opportunity to ad lib at times too, but again, as an actor, the character, you turn into the character. You literally, in a way, you know, morph into the character. So some things I would say that wasn't necessarily in the script was what I felt like this character believed. And it was just the way that I did them. And so, you know, those were the things that, you know, I thought added the most kind of controversy to the script and the stuff that I had to defend at that time.
It was interesting to me because it felt like these are guys that are now yourself, this level of success. You know, I've done all this stuff, I'm there. And some people trying to say, oh, all right, don't go too far. You know, yeah. Because I guess I was thrown because it was very clearly a character. It wasn't even somebody questioning your stand up. Like, you were playing a role.
Yeah.
And got heat.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, one thing for us is that, in most cases, we protect our idols in a way. You know, that's one of the things I think that was what I got the most out of the situation. It wasn't so much that it was said, it just that it was said in such a public forum, right, that it's like, all right, look, protect our idols, man. Don't just go out there. And I think Jesse Jackson gave me that as one of the most kind of prolific things for me to hear. He was just kind of saying that for the most part, they can take that clip and then give it to little kids outside this country and make that who these people are. They'll just show that to them over and over again. And then generationally, Martin Luther King will become that and not who he is. And so I was like, I understood that. I said, you know, that's more for the distributor though to deal with. That ain't gonna be my job at this point. You might want to get on MGM, but about that, but I did understand it from that point of view, is that, you know, for most of these guys, you know, the Rosa Parks of it all, they wanted to protect, you know, our idols. And so I understood it from that point of view, and, you know, and I had to at least give props for that, you know. I got you.
Right. Well, and you heard it and you learned from it. And I segue into comments recently about Will Smith, because you said if you lived in that particular time with social media trying to shut you down for something, instead, people talked to you, they did it with love, you learned from it. You recently said this is a path too far with people who are trying to completely silence Will Smith's career for what happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I always say this. We've all known Will Smith as this affable, great, unique, talented individual most of our careers. When you let somebody, you let a moment be the defining thing to where now it's all our responsibility to throw this guy in a trash can because of an action that you deemed a line crossed too far, then, you know, again, who are we? Like, guys, I used to always say people act like people. That's, and I got in trouble for this a little bit. It was a controversial statement. I said, not that I wanted it to happen to Chris Rock. That's my brother. Like, I love Chris Rock, too. But what I felt like is America had got to the point that they forgot that it's a thing where you can get this smacked out of you. Like, it's a part of life where people start to be on Twitter and writing letters and saying what they want to about you and talking about your kids. And you forget, it's a thing in life, dog. If you go too far with the wrong person, they're going to slap the shit out of you. That's going to be, and I was like, that's all I felt like. There was a wake-up call, and I got that. It happened on television, and that was wrong, and we should save our idols, and we should protect them, but... What I feel like that's the only way Will Smith would have did something like that. He just will. He's not that dude. He's not a villain. Don't make him a villain. This was something that was personal. It happened to him, and he responded. That was that. Leave it alone.
There's a meme that goes around on social media from Mike Tyson that said, social media made people way too comfortable disrespecting people and not getting punched in the face for it.
Exactly. And everybody loved that one. But it's because it's a quote and it's Mike Tyson saying it. And it's so true. It's one of my favorite. Everybody got a plan until they get smacked in the mouth. Like, okay. You like, right. But, you know, we grew up, you know, like, again, from St. Louis, being in the space, that respect is one of the common things about it. And I say this, you know, as a man, as a father, respect is the key, dog. If I show you respect, you show me respect. If you show me disrespect, then these things start to elevate a circumstance. And so we want to have more decorum in the world. We want to have, that's why I'm, you know, again, about all these things about, you know, that go into the political realm where people feel like they could just say anything about anybody. It's where you create this kind of, this high energy where the lines are short and the fuse is short. And, you know, right now the world needs to be in a point where we can talk, you can disagree. We can have, but we don't have to get there as long as we show respect. Like you can't be disrespectful and then try to tell me you right. That don't work.
So your shows are about the real, the funny, getting out there and exploring stuff. You're on tour now, hitting Philly, May 19th. Man. Lee Corus Center. Is this like a new kind of Kings of Comedy? Because you got people together again. You, D.L. Hughley, Mike Epps, Young Fly, Earthquake.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this has been fun. This is one, again, man, I always love these kind of opportunities because we got a young promoter, Chicago. It's a group of them. It's a black promoter collective. But I love when these kind of ideas, so not only just the guys on the front of the stage, but the guys that's behind us putting the show together. We're doing it with a group of people that are building a business. They needed the opportunity to be out here promoting and doing shows. You know, once you kind of go into the arena thing, then, you know, the Live Nations and the AEG, they become the AI, them the big guys that take over like arena tours. So the black promoter ends up being pushed to the side. So we've been successful. We've been out with these guys a couple of times. We grew the business, you know, by being on tour with them during the holiday period for like 3 years in a row. We just do these holiday right at the end of the year, just do these big holiday shows. And they eventually grew to where we can be out. We've done 30 cities. We coming to Philly and we doing arenas and it's fun, man. Me, Mike Epps, we all partners and legends and different. So I feel like the audience gets a little bit of everything that they love, man. Like Mike Epps is wild and off the hook, like you know him to be, but he's funny and a genius. And then you got DC Young Fly, the hot young gun. He like on stage, you know, working, being magical, creative. He'll, you know, he's a creative little dude, man. He do his thing. And Earthquake legend, he been rocking DL Hughley, my partner legend, near me, man. That's we've been having a great time on this tour. So Philly is part starting to be a part of the end of it. We're about the last 6-7 dates. And so, you know, but we're gonna go back out in the fall. But I definitely want Philly to show up, which is one of my favorite towns. I did so many different little venues in Philly, and you know, the people, they always pull up, and it's always a good time, man.
I don't count people's wallets, but you don't have to do this. So you're doing this because you still love doing it.
Man, you know, it was one of those things that I was telling somebody that, you know, you got the TV show, you could do movies, but all of them come with producers and you know, other writers and things that, you know, people have agendas, things that they got to get accomplished. And so you got to take all that when you do a TV show. You got to see what the network needs to accomplish and then what the writers wrote, and they want their words to be said. But when you do stand up, it's you, your audience, and your point of view. And you got to try to touch base with them human beings right there. It's just no more magical situation than that. Like, it's really powerful. It's almost like being a pastor, I think, like, where your job is to come out and try to get somebody to laugh, like to let go of whatever it is that they've been dealing with. Like, ooh, thank you, bro. Like, so that's, I take it so personal when you go out on stage, because that's what it is. It's literally a connection with somebody, you know, in a group of somebody's at this point. It's trying to make them just let go of they regular stress, you know what I'm saying? Like, and have a good time. So yeah, man, once you do it, it's the shot. It's the shot, man. You gotta go in. That's the one. That's the adrenaline you want.
Well, respect your time. I just got one or two more, man. I appreciate you spending this much time with us. One of the things that we always talk about on The Pulse is things that people are doing, how they're using their voice for good. So you've had a charitable foundation for years. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I started out, my mother was a school teacher, you know, and so she just always, and it's just what, you know, my younger sister, myself, who's also an educator, she's a professor at Pepperdine. So my mother's passed since, but she always kind of instilled in us, you know, this idea of, you know, giving back. So I've done scholarships since 96. I've, you know, put a lot of people through school with their first tuition money. That's what we did. We do the first year, you know, figure out how to help kids through school. And I always joke with the kids, don't mind the loan though. I'll give you a scholarship, but you got to graduate. I got to see, if you don't graduate, you gonna be my money back. That's all I'm saying. So I'll be walking kids down, but then it's grown since then. My mother passed. And so we now since have done a hospital, a wing at a hospital in St. Louis, St. Mary's. We have the Rosetta Boyce Kyles Women's Pavilion. This is health-oriented, all women's health programs, you know, mammograms, adolescent injuries for kids that, you know, young girls that play sports and get hurt. It was like a real kind of epidemic of that going on in St. Louis. So that didn't have medical treatment, so they can go to this Women's Pavilion for those kind of things. Rural doctor visits, start to, you know, do equipment where they can do the, you know, the video visits for the cities and that's far from the, you know, far from the hospital, the small towns. So, you know, these are the kind of things that I raise money for. Of course, my dad suffered with diabetes, so we give to diabetes, and then Boys and Girls Club as something. And again, as a young man, growing up without that father figure, participated in a lot. So Boys and Girls Club is one of our big participations where we just want to make sure that kids got somewhere to go, especially for single parent homes, where they can, you know, make sure their kids in a safe environment while the parents still working and hustling and doing what they got to do. The kids can go there and educate and learn and do the homework and all that. So we do that both in St. Louis and in California. So that's what I give to.
That's how we generally end the show. It is the quote. I'm going to let you have the last word. We have to have you come back when you're new. We didn't even touch on your book that's coming out.
Oh, yeah, man.
The depth of the book. That's a whole nother episode. So we'll try to set that up. But the last word on The Pulse is, what does use your voice for good mean to you?
Oh man, use your voice for good, man. I think that is the idea of understanding how you can affect your community, affect generations to come by, you know, being a great example, not just saying what it is that you're about, but being what it is that you're about. And then, you know, getting out and trying to spread that word, that being exactly who you are. If it's just to be a great dresser, I used to tell somebody, there was a group of guys, you know, half of my dress style came from these guys that was old. They were seniors in high school, and they used to just dress nice. And they represented style and class and swagginess before swag was the word. And it's that thing that's they did it for good, because they don't know they affected a whole group of us young guys that just wanted to come to school with some nice clothes on. We didn't want to wear grimy jeans and t-shirts. We wanted to dress up like them dudes and wear sweaters and hats. And so, you know, that's what it's all about. Be a positive energy, be a powerful energy, use your voice for good. That's it.
And I appreciate you taking some time with us. I could talk forever, but I know you got things to do. I thank you, because for years, if you was having a bad day or whatever, putting on the original Kings of Comedy had a way of making everything turn around and you could just laugh for a while. I appreciate you for that and for your career.
Yeah, man. Thank you, brother. This is awesome, man. I didn't know what to expect, but this is great, man. This was a fun interview, and you keep doing this, man. This is I think people really, this need to be national. This is a cold show right here, man. It's dope.
Guys, thanks so much for listening to the Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast today. Most of these shows are fun and highlights for me, but as I said, Cedric the Entertainer was just a good one for me, because not only is he hilarious, but his story is inspiring. How seriously he takes his craft and empowering and helping other people with his message and his comedy is also something that is inspiring to me. And I always enjoy people who are just as pleasant and positive as you hoped they would be as you watch them from a distance. And he was all of that. I would like you to push that button, click on that button up in the upper right corner or left corner, wherever it is on your screen or phone, the one that says subscribe, so you get a notification every Monday when the next episode of The Pulse comes out. I also encourage you to head on over to YouTube and look for some of the past episodes. I think you will find some fun shows you may not have seen. Just recently, Tracy Morgan and Sarah Silverman and Michael Rappaport, and now Cedric the Entertainer. And that's before you start going back to Macy Gray and Jan LaVanzant. There's a lot of them. So check them out. Hit me up on social media at BillAFox29. I'm always eager to hear from you. And I leave you today, as I always do, reminding you that whenever you can, use your voice for good and have a good one.